Ladies and gentlemen, good morning and welcome. My name is Komla Dumont. I'm a presenter with BBC World News. I present a program called, interestingly enough, European Mornings, which is what I did just this morning. However, the role of which I think I'm most proud is I'm also the presenter of a program called Focus on Africa. We launched it 3 months ago at BBC World Television. And I think that in itself tells a story. 3 months ago, I think the BBC also recognized that it is important to give the full coverage to the continent, which is not just an exciting place to cover, not just compelling stories, but is changing incredibly quickly. So for those of you in the financial sector, those of you who are economists, those of you who are business people, you know that this is the time for the continent. So today we want to have a conversation about Africa, and it's not just one of those conversations that we glorify the things that we think are good and we condemn the things that we think are bad, but we want to have a meaningful conversation about what is happening on the continent, stripping away, if you like, the rhetoric about Africa and drilling down to what's really happening on the continent. And we have a really excellent panel right here with us. I've had the pleasure of working with some of them already, and I think they're going to make some very powerful arguments in favor of taking a second look at the continent, if you have not already. So without further ado, let me give you an introduction to the gentleman and the lady who are with us today. We'll start with Charles Robertson. I think some of you have already picked up copies of the publication that he's been working on and I've been reading over the past couple of weeks. Charles is Renaissance Capital's global chief economist and head of the firm's macro strategy unit. He's a leading emerging markets specialist, and he covers a lot of global economic themes, but his focus right now is on the continent. And he's lead author of this book called The Fastest Billion, The Story Behind Africa's Economic Revolution. I met with Charles a few weeks ago at another event, and he said, Komla, you have to read this. Komla, you need to take a look at this. And I did, and he's kept me up for several days with some very powerful thoughts, as well as with, of course, his colleagues, some of whom are here, co-authored this report, and we'll be hearing from them as well a bit later on. Charles, it's good to have you and good to see you again, and looking forward to an interesting debate as you make your arguments. Jide Olarewaju is a partner at Satya Capital LLP. He's an independent investment firm analyst. It's also focused on Africa. He was formerly a vice president at Morgan Stanley. In fact, looking at his CV, it's a who's who of the banking sector. He's worked at Goldman Sachs. He's worked at Shell, investment banking, gas and power. But, you know, if you need to be impressed, he also holds a master's degree in mechanical engineering and a specialization in nuclear reactor technology, which in simple terms means he's really smart and he knows what he's talking about. Jide, it's good to see you. Welcome. I don't know if any of you are on this lady's mailing list. I am. Every day I wake up, check the inbox, and there is what I like to call the Razia Report, if you ever choose to copyright that. It was my idea. Razia Khan is the head of regional research at Standard Chartered, which has received recognition for providing the best research on Africa. On a daily basis, I open that inbox, and Razia provides detailed analysis on the emerging economies, what's happening in the continent, combining not just the economics, but the political as well. So if you're not on that list, I urge you now, at the end of this, to make sure you get on it. Now, during her time with Standard Chartered, Razia Khan has been acknowledged pretty much as the leading Africa analyst, that's when it comes to African economies, and linking that to, of course, what is happening around the world as well. Razia, it's great to see you. Great to have you on the panel. So, ladies and gentlemen, what's going to happen now is that Charles is going to give us an overview of his thoughts and the thoughts of his co-authors about what is happening on the continent. We'll also hear from Razia and from Jide. And after that, you know, I'll field a few questions, just get us going. But prepare yourselves to challenge you know, our panelists, and let's have a stimulating and compelling discussion. Charles, over to you.
Thanks very much.
If you wouldn't mind, Razia and Jide, would you mind just moving down so that we could have a clear view of the... Thank you very much.
And I'm going to have a control... This is a copy of the book. This is the first time Renaissance Capital has done a book. It hasn't all gone exactly according to the time schedule. There's an excerpt there, which we'd love you to take. But if you want to see the whole book, it's there it is for you. This is what we can manage today. Hopefully in 2 or 3 weeks, it'll be on Kindle, on Amazon, and everything else. And in the next few weeks, you can follow what we're twittering about here, including my colleague Natando Ndebili, who's in the audience, fantastic banks analyst, head of Africa research for us, and just fantastic author, part of the book, and Yvonne Mango, who's our chief economist for Africa as well. So we're going to be trying to keep up to date and flagging what's in the piece. I've now given myself an impossible mission. I've got 7 minutes to talk about Africa, and it's not to try and justify that it's going to be a $29 trillion economy by 2050, bigger than Europe and America together. The challenge is to try and do 20 slides in 5 minutes. So you're going to have to bear with me. This is going to be like blipverts. What's going right in Africa? First, government debt has halved from 80% of GDP down to 30% in the last 10 years. At the same time as the West, we've seen its debt levels, G7 debt levels, government debt levels, rise to 120% of GDP. African governments are running policy far better than they used to. African governments running budget surpluses through the middle of the last decade. Yes, a deficit during the global financial crisis, but rapidly got that back under control. G7 countries have not got their budget deficits under control. African governments are looking more and more German by the day. This is what the Germans would love everyone to be doing what Africa's doing. Unfortunately, the Spanish and the Greeks don't behave. How much of this good story is just China? It's played a big role. It's helped. Exports out of Africa, this is Sub-Sahara, South Africa and North Africa, about 170 billion in the late 90s. We're now running at nearly $700 billion. That is helpful. But China's only about one-seventh of Africa's total exports, about $100 billion. And China's in this strange position where it's running a trade deficit with Africa. Most unused to that, which is why it's lending so much money and trying to encourage African governments to employ Chinese construction companies to build roads, so at least China exports something back to Africa. But the rise of foreign direct investment happened well before China. Back in the 70s and the 80s, Africa was getting less than 0.5% of GDP in foreign direct investment. No one wanted to put their money into that continent. Since the mid-90s, it's been running at 2 or 3 or 4% of GDP. And this flood of cash is creating jobs, creating new markets, new oil discoveries. You've seen oil revenues go from $1 billion in the 60s, in today's money, to about $35 billion in the 90s, to $235 billion this year. And that huge increase, that $235 billion of oil revenues, is more than double the infrastructure needs that the World Bank says Africa has, of $90 to $100 billion a year. So the money is now available to do infrastructure as well. And it's going to pick up. We already know the production in Africa is going to go from 10 million barrels a day to about 12 million barrels a day this decade. So there's been a huge boom in the last 30 or 40 years, all of it in sub-Sahara. This morning's news is the Tullow Oil has found another oil discovery in northern Kenya. So this is just part of what is people beginning to discover what's under African soil. New mining projects. The new mines, new iron ore projects are expected to go from zero of new output now to maybe 600 million tons of new output in 10 years' time. The third fast-growing economy in the world today is Sierra Leone, up 21%, the IMF reckons. Why? Because one of these projects is coming on stream. It makes a huge difference to the growth rates of some of these countries. So you'd think from this it's all commodities and China and oil and mining. In fact, 50% of the growth, 53% of the growth in the last 7 years comes from services. Mining is actually down here at 14%. So the real boom in Africa hasn't been China, it's been telecoms. There's been 500 million SIM cards sold in the last 7 years in a continent that everyone knew was too poor to be able to afford telephones. And banking is going to be a boom area. At the moment, we are stuffed in the West with debt of 200% of GDP, private sector debt. You've got South Africa, one of the richer countries, at about 65-70% of GDP, and Sub-Sahara is down here at 20-40%. when that booms, countries grow fast. If you look at China today, it's up there at 130% of GDP. This is what Africa can be achieving over the next 20 to 30 years. I think crucial differences, though, right now, is that the number of Chinese young people have dropped by 20% this decade. 30% down if you count the US Census Bureau's estimates. The number of young people are disappearing in China. And what that means is that this decade, unlike previous decades, if you want cheap labour to move into textiles and light industry, Africa is going to be the source for that labour. Education is also crucial. If you go back 30 years, less than 10% of people in sub-Saharan Africa had secondary school education. Now that figure is 40. That's not good, but it's a hell of a lot better than it was 30 years ago. And 40% is roughly where India was in 1990, or Mexico and Turkey were in 1975. And we know what happened to those countries after that. I could also show you something about democracy. This is a picture of Africa by GDP. The pink are weak democracies. This is a strong democracy. Actually, most people in Africa are now living in strong or weak democracies, rather than autocracies. Eritrea, Morocco are among those which are still seen as fairly autocratic. Now, corruption comes up a lot. What about the problem of operating in Africa? Is the corruption not too much? What I'm showing you here is per capita GDP, how rich you are, versus your Transparency International corruption rating. What you'll notice is that a good rating, a low, not much corruption, is very well correlated with high wealth. As you get poorer, corruption is more and more of a problem. So you can say, I will not invest in Africa because there is corruption. What you're really saying is, I will not invest in a poor country. And yet, as countries get richer, they will move up that curve and they will become less corrupt. One of the things that most economists do is make a bad forecast. In fact, almost all economists make bad forecasts, but they do this in a fairly predictable way. Most economists look at the last 10 years of history and say, what was the growth rate? It was 2% in the last 10 years. So in 2000, it's a hopeless continent. After 10 years of growth, the average growth of the last 10 years has been 5 to 6%. Therefore, Africa is rising. It's not very sophisticated. What we are arguing in this book is that actually we are following a trajectory already done by India, already done by Asia. For 30 years, African growth has been identical to Indian growth from 1960 to 1990. And we know what happened in India between 1990 and 2010. It got faster. Despite many of the problems that we're still aware of, it got faster. And India is 10 years behind developing Asia. It's been identical to developing Asia for the last 20 years. So we can make a fair assumption that actually African growth is just going to get faster and faster. Nigeria will overtake South Africa by 2014, Germany by 2037, in today's money, Japan by 2047, in today's money. So where Japan is today. The aviation boom. There's going to be 100 million flights in Africa in 2010, roughly. 200 million at the end of this decade. 800 million, 1.7 billion. Think of the Heathrow Airport. One runway, should we have... Well, so we've got two runways, should we have a third? In Africa, we should be thinking we've got one runway, we need 17 in 40 years' time. That's the boom that will come if they just continue to follow India for the next 20, 30 years. Motor vehicle sales will beat America by 2030 and China by 2040. And the result will be this. Huge amounts of wealth and GDP in East Africa, Ethiopia, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, Nigeria, as well as North Africa. South Africa, much less important. I will stop there and try and hand over to somebody else. But that's the basic message, right, some of the messages we're trying to get across.
All right. Judith, Razi, you're not doing a PowerPoint.
No, okay. Judy, kindly join us up on the stage. Oh, Charles, you can stay. Don't leave just yet.
It's okay. I'll
okay. All right. Would you like to? All right. Then I shall just move towards the middle.
It's a glass podium. I can still be seen behind it.
Good stuff.
Those slides in Africa.
And while we agree, of course, with the overall thrust, Africa has been growing for the last decade. Africa has been outperforming the global average. Increasingly, what we're seeing is the discussion on African growth becoming that much more nuanced. And while we don't doubt at all that we are seeing a step up in Africa's growth rate, it fits very much with what we at Standard Chartered have described as a growth and commodity supercycle. It doesn't actually take that much of an acceleration in growth for it to be defined as a supercycle. All we need is a meaningful change from where we were before to where we are today. Notwithstanding the global economic crisis, we have seen growth rates in Africa continuing to increase, perhaps will soon surpass their pre-crisis trends, and that we think is encouraging. However, there's still a lot that needs to be said about the challenges that Africa faces, and I'm just going to spend a little bit of time running through some of those, not denying at all and not disagreeing with the broad thrust of what we've heard, but thinking that maybe casting a more critical lens at what is happening in Africa will be useful. Can Africa actually replicate the development experience of Asia? Now, here it might be important to draw the distinction between economic growth, and yes, it will be very easy for economies like Sierra Leone, starting off a very low base, to achieve extraordinary growth rates, 20 to 30% on the back of new iron ore production. But there's a meaningful difference between economic growth, especially off a weak base, and economic transformation. Increasingly, what Africa's policymakers are starting to look at is that transformation aspect. Is development actually happening? Are African economies transforming? One of the problems that we have is just looked at in a very, very basic way, the structure of Africa's economies. The commodity dependence that was in place a few decades ago, if anything, has worsened. Commodity producers in Africa, even though a lot of the growth has come from the non-commodities sector, it's been fueled by consumption, it's been consistent with the rise in financial intermediation and private sector credit that we see in the region, but fundamentally, the structure of African economies still very commodity dependent, and that, of course, creates challenges, especially in the context of a global economic slowdown. The other question that we would need to explore is that of inclusive growth. Yes, African economies have been growing. The commodities story has generally been good news for Africa. But because so much of that impetus has been driven by natural resources, Africa remains, if one can generalize about the whole region, relatively unequal. The second most unequal region, coming only after Latin America in that respect. And as much as we celebrate the region's trend towards democratization, I think one has to look also at the quality of democracy that is in place and the challenges that these rising levels of inequality are going to pose potentially for the future path of politics in many different countries. Then there is the matter of demographics. Here is an area where we are fundamentally very positive about Africa. We know about the growth in Africa's populous economies. We've seen the kind of growth rate already experienced by the likes of Nigeria and Ethiopia. And Africa, of course, is going to continue to see a big step up in its growth, even if we just see a continuation of current consumption trends. Because unlike much of the rest of the world, which is aging very rapidly, Africa is going to see this boost a larger working age population as a share of the total. And other things being equal, although there are, of course, challenges, that should mean a rise in consumption, a rise in overall growth, a rise in the kind of economic returns available in Africa. If we consider Nigeria today, it's thought, according to UN population projections, that by 2035, Nigeria may well be the fourth most populous economy in the world. And by 2055, it's likely to be the third most populous, after only India and China. But what is very meaningful is that if we look at those UN population projections and extrapolate out over the next century, it's not just Nigeria. Roughly around half of the world's most populous economies are going to be in Africa. Now, that does mean that in terms of the kind of growth that this region represents, it is going to be too important to ignore. But that also means that the challenges need that much more attention. Is Africa making the most of its human capital endowment even today? We saw the charts showing a lot more Africans receiving secondary education, and certainly the trend has been positive. But one still has to be concerned at a situation where, in terms of primary school completion rates, we're still talking about a ratio of about 50%. If we're looking at whether Africa can replicate the development experience of Asia, one of the key missing factors is the kind of skills level, the skills base that would be needed with that sort of educational attainment. This is still an area that needs a lot of attention. There's also the whole issue of competitiveness. Now, much debate about whether an African growth model should replicate an Asian growth model. Should it be about export-driven growth? Should it be about cheap manufacturing, cheap labor in African countries? Yes, if we look at just the wage structure, many African countries are already much more competitive than their Asian counterparts. But they do not yet have the large-scale infrastructure that would make that kind of export-driven growth possible. That's a concern. There's been a lot of talk also about regionalization, but pay attention to how much of those regional agreements that are supposed to be driving an Africa super economic bloc, pay attention to how much of that is actually being enforced, how much of it is actually operational, and clearly there's a large gap between the intention and where Africa is. Now, not to be too downbeat, we do, of course, believe in Africa's growth prospects. And if we're looking holistically at the way global growth is going to be driven, there's no question that African countries with relatively good fundamentals still are primed for growth. There are going to be challenges. The quality of democracy does need to be looked at. But overall, we think we're moving in the right direction. Nonetheless, these very important facets, what could go wrong? What isn't changing fast enough? What is the structural transformation that still needs to happen? We think that these questions continue to be important. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Morning, everyone. So I think they've both given a good macro overview, and I think, you know, I represent the link between Charles's optimism and Razia's let's not call it pessimism, but maybe reality. Maybe a few seconds. Let me talk about Satya because they're both well-known institutions compared to us. Satya is a private investment fund which invests exclusively in Africa. We have been investing in one shape or the other in Africa since 1998. The chairman of Satya is a gentleman called Mo Ibrahim, who some of you may have heard about because of his work in telecoms as well as the work he does with the Governance Prize. When we think about Africa at Satya, we look at it this way. We are investing in the opportunities created by the formalization of African economies. And what does that mean? Well, formalization means urbanization, the creation of a broader educated class, the creation of a taxpayer base, the improving regulatory and governance environment. So that formalization means that there are some sectors which we see as very interesting and where we think we're going to see the first benefits of what Charles is speaking about. But In our minds, this is where the challenge side that Razia spoke about is important, because you can't say every sector is going to be important today in Africa. When we look at the market, there are four preference sectors we look at: financial services, consumer goods, TMT, and when we think about those sectors, what I think is very interesting is that in financial services, for example, we've made an investment in consumer goods, we've made an investment in healthcare, we've made an investment in TMT, we've made an investment. And over the last 4 years, what we've seen in those sectors are the benefits that Charles is talking about, but also the problems that Razia has spoken about. Let me give two very practical examples. In financial services, one of the challenges you have is in the banking sector, you have to roll out your branches to reach people. The cost of rolling those branches out means that in every branch, you have to do your own power, your own water, your own IT connectivity. So the cost of rolling out branches is much higher than it would be in these markets. So when you think about that and you say, how am I going to scale my business, you would expect to have lower profitability in the long term in financial services businesses. And this is where I think there's an essential link between where Charles is and where Razia is, which is you have to locally adapt your business model to be successful in these markets. In financial services, that means using technology. We're invested in a bank which has the smallest number of branches, but it's the most profitable. And the reason for that is because 5-6 years ago, if you're in Lagos, every Friday, the banking halls were packed with people who were trying to get money out for the weekend. And that was very inefficient. A lot of banks built out branches, but what this bank did was invested in their ATM network. Today, more cash goes out of their ATM network than from their bank branch. So that's using technology to locally adapt your business model. I think the other thing I would point out in Africa is that you can't expect to go into Africa and find problems solved that are still wrong in your market. So if you have credit issues in your global business model, you will have them in Africa too. And a lot of investors, this is where they make a mistake. If I look at our healthcare business, it's one of the challenges. You're still going to have issues with receivables anywhere you are in the world. But again, you can locally adapt your business model to deal with that. Another thing we've seen with local adaptation is in consumer goods. We have an investment in a toothpaste business in Tanzania, which has number one market share. What is interesting in that business is we see a lot of growth in what I call single-use sachets. So these are, you buy your toothpaste every morning and you use it. Why is that? Because it's a lot of working capital to buy a big tube for 1 month of supply and keep it on your shelf when you don't know if you're going to eat tomorrow. It doesn't make sense. So locally adapting your business model means changing your pack sizes. And when you talk to the big multinationals, that's what they've realized. The final thing, and of course I would say that, is your choice of investment partner is key. If you have the right partner, it prevents you from making the obvious mistakes and helps you learn faster. It also means that you find people who have already gone through the trouble of unlocking that business model. So they understand the consumer behavior and the consumer need and where the demand goes. Final point I would say is you have to balance the Africa growth story with what Razia has pointed out in the shortage of talent. And we see that a lot in our businesses. Our thesis when we invested in the healthcare business was we had already gone and mapped out all the diaspora medical professionals. We met people, say, for example, in the Nigerians who are in the UK who are medical doctors. And we thought it's a very simple thesis. You invest in a healthcare business and you repatriate them onto the ground. In reality, it's very difficult. Why? Because the local doctors said, no, if they're not trained here, they can't come back home. So we had absurd situations trying to get them accredited. So these are people who are highly qualified, who you can't get onto the ground. We had the same challenge with bringing back what I call CEO and executive talent. And what I find most interesting about it is if you're a very high-quality Nigerian and someone says, come and work in healthcare, you rank it below telecoms, financial services, etc. So we ended up having to bring expats because when we thought about how much we're paying versus the talent, it made sense to get an expat. So the talent issue is very important, and I think, as Razia said, that will be the key to unlocking African growth. Thank you.
Thank you very much.